This interview will become part of the Georgetown Public Library's Oral History Collection. This project focuses on people's memories of Marshall and Carver schools and the issues and events of the 1950s and 60s that led to desegregation. My name is Mandy Shelton. It is November 4th, is that right? And it is approximately 5 o'clock. And your name, sir?
Milton Jordan.
Milton Jordan. Okay, do you have any nicknames?
No.
No. And what is your birth date?
March 7th, 1940.
How long have you lived in Georgetown?
I've lived in Georgetown now for 3 years. I moved here after I retired at the beginning of 2006.
Okay. And then you lived here a little before that as well?
I was a student at Southwestern from 1958 to 1962, and I lived here through 1963.
Okay. So you stayed one more year after you graduated? When you lived here the first time, did you live on campus?
I lived on campus for 3 years, and for the last 2 years, I lived in Hutto and commuted to Georgetown.
Really?
Yeah.
I imagine Hutto was a lot smaller.
Hutto was tiny.
Was there a reason you lived in Hutto?
I was serving the Methodist Church in Hutto as a student pastor. I was a student pastor for 2 years.
Okay.
1 year I was at Southwestern. The following year I was at Episcopal Theological Seminary in Austin.
Okay.
In graduate school.
Okay. And then those 2 years you were also in Hutto as a minister. Okay. Mm-hmm. Where did you originally come from before you were a student at Southwestern?
Houston.
Houston area?
Yeah.
So what finally brought you back to Georgetown?
I would have come back as soon as I possibly could.
Okay.
I was one of the students who loved Georgetown, loved being at Southwestern, and hated it when it was over. There was a group of us like that. There was also a group of students at Southwestern when I was here. This is probably still true. Those of us who really liked the place and liked everything about it and would have stayed here if we could, and those who couldn't wait to get out of this dump. You know, just the sooner we get gone from here, the better. I was in the group that really liked it, so when I retired, I came back.
Did you, so you went to Southwestern and you got a bachelor's?
I got my BA at Southwestern, right.
Did you major in religion?
I majored in history,
tell
you the truth.
Did you have a minor?
I minored in English.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Were you part of any groups, any organizations?
Yes, I was part of several groups on the campus. I was in the Young Democrats. I was in the Mask and Wig, which was the performance group. It's like the Seraphim School now. We're the ones that put on plays during the year. Did various performances and that sort of thing. I was in a fraternity. And,
which fraternity?
Phi Delta Theta.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I was in the History Club. I was sort of in the Student Christian Association, but I wasn't really very active in that.
Okay. Did you, were you active in organizations all 4 years, or did you have to
my senior year, I wasn't all that active because I was preaching in Hutto at the time, and I wasn't as active then my senior year, which was the fall of 61 through the spring of 62.
Okay.
And I worked on the megaphone for 2 years. Also,
you were writing.
The megaphone is the campus newspaper.
Right. And you wrote for it?
I did.
Okay. What did you write?
I wrote sports, actually.
You were a sports writer?
Right. I was a friend of mine was the sports editor my sophomore year, and I wrote sports then, and I was the sports editor my junior year.
Okay.
And but the staff of the Megaphone in those days, we most of us did a little of everything.
And so you didn't, you weren't part of it your freshman year?
No.
What caused you to join your friend on the staff, or you just became interested?
Well, I was interested my freshman year. I just didn't write anything for them.
Okay.
And but the people that got to do it as a, when I was a sophomore were all friends of mine, and so I was able to be more involved then.
Did you take any journalism courses or?
No, we didn't really do that at Southwestern. I don't remember that we had such a thing as a journalism class. That may have been, but I didn't know about it.
Okay. So you just learned on the job?
Well, sort of, yeah.
And did you cover all of the sports at Southwestern?
Yeah, I covered intramurals as well as intercollegiate. And I covered, I mean, there were a couple of other people that wrote stories as well, but
and after Southwestern, you went on to the ministry.
I went to graduate school in Austin for a year, and I finished my master's degree in at SMU in Dallas.
Which high school did you go to in Houston?
I went to Baytown Lee.
Baytown Lee.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That's a suburb on the. It's in East Harris County.
Okay.
I don't know how much you know about Harris County, but Baytown is a refinery town east of Houston. I would have said in those days it's about 30 or so miles east of Houston, but it's pretty much part of all of that down there. It's not
moving from Houston to Georgetown as an 18 year old. Did you were you introduced to sort of a different racial atmosphere, the way the races work together, or?
No. Segregation was a absolute reality. So, in fact, such a reality that most of us didn't even realize it. At least most of us white boys didn't realize it. It was just a reality. And it was a reality in Baytown and Houston. We had moved to Houston in the summertime before I actually came to Southwestern. We'd moved into town to pretty much downtown Houston now. But the situation was the same. This was just a smaller town with a much smaller school, and Southwestern was a very small college when I came. I mean, much, much smaller than it is now.
Do you know how many people?
Well, actually, I think my freshman year, we ended my freshman year with less than 500 students total.
Total
students, all four grades, four classes.
Wow.
And it's now, you know, 1,200 or 1,300 students. So it's, now it grew a little bit while I was here, so that when I left, it was maybe 600 students or so, but it's double the size it was at its largest when I was here now. And the city of Georgetown was much smaller than it is now. I mean, lots smaller.
Can you kind of tell me about the layout of the town back then? Was it Southwestern, I'm guessing?
The university campus, that was called 12th Street. They did not call that University Avenue in those days. That was just 12th Street.
So it wasn't four lanes?
No, it was just like any other of those numbered streets, except it was the highway. It's always been Highway 29.
Okay.
And Southwestern was at the end of 12th Street. I mean, that's where the town ended, was with Southwestern. And the neighborhoods across the street on, oh, I don't know, Laurel, Olive, what are those streets that have names of trees? Like everything going east from downtown has tree names. I don't think the streets, I don't know this for sure, but in my memory at least, I don't think the streets west of Rock had names at all. I don't think the streets over here had names. This was where the African American community lived, on the in the part of town west of Rock, and I don't think any of them, those streets had names. What's now called Scenic was just referred to as the Ridge. Or on that side of town, it was referred to by a nastier name that included Ridge. But it was just called the Ridge.
So Rock Street was kind of a dividing line?
Rock Street was a dividing line, yes. The black community lived west of Rock and north, I think, of 12th Street. Okay. Or maybe north of 9th, right out there.
So did you spend a lot of time within the town of Georgetown as a student, or were you really isolated on the
Well, no. We spent a lot of time. Some of us. Our fraternity did community service projects every year, at least once. And one year we did a fall and a spring community service project. And usually they were on the ridge. We built a porch with a wheelchair ramp for a family over here somewhere. We worked on the church over here one year. I don't remember. Cleanup, basically.
So you volunteered within the black community?
Right. Well, it was our service project for our chapter, our fraternity.
Was that unusual? Or
no.
Okay.
That wasn't unusual.
Okay.
I didn't think.
And did you eat in restaurants in town all the time, or did you stay on campus and go to the cafeteria?
Well, the restaurants, you use plural. I guess that would be true, but they weren't. When I was here, there were two restaurants in downtown Georgetown, the King Cole and the L&M. And we ate in them pretty regular.
And they were segregated?
Oh, yeah. Everything in Georgetown was segregated when I was here. Everything in Georgetown was totally segregated. There was, if African American people wanted to buy a hamburger at the L&M, they came to the kitchen door and ordered the hamburger in back of the restaurant, on what was sort of an alley. Wasn't even really an alley, just the back of the restaurant. And they could order a hamburger and they could get it.
They just couldn't eat in the
they
restaurant.
They couldn't come in the front.
What was the other restaurant you mentioned?
King Cole.
The King Cole?
Mm-hmm.
The King Cole? Was it the same way that
blacks
could order through the back door? But
yeah. The only African Americans that you ever saw in the restaurants were the cooks and the dishwashers. That's all.
Was there ever a time when you were, I mean, you said you did service projects in the black community, but was there a time when you were interacting with African Americans?
Not really. The thing that I was really involved in the spring of 1961, there was some ferment. Those were the first years of the sit-ins. Do you know about that? I know you don't remember that, but do you know about that in Greenville, South Carolina, and in Nashville, Tennessee, and a couple of other places? Organized groups of black, mostly students, began to go to restaurants, places with lunch counters and so forth, and order. They'd go in the front door and order. So there was the beginning of some civil rights actions taking place elsewhere. Some of us at Southwestern were interested in that. We thought that was a something that we ought to consider. Southwestern was totally white. We had no African American students. We had some Hispanic students, and we had foreign students who came on a special deal, usually arranged, I think, by the church on campus. But we had no African American students at Southwestern the whole 4 years that I was there. But we were interested in that. Southwestern was a major employer of African American people in Georgetown. On the building and grounds crews and on the in the cafeteria crew. And some of us, particularly one friend of mine named Mark Lett, who was working on the paper that I was working on, had worked in the Commons, it was called. I think it's still called the Commons. Worked in the Commons. And he knew two or three of the African American staff in the Commons, and was involved in discussions with them about the realities of segregated life in Georgetown and in at Southwestern in particular. And he wrote a column for the paper, which, because of a series of events, the editor of the paper was told we could not run that column at that time. The editor, another friend of mine, Dan Adamson, was the editor, told Mark that we couldn't run it, and Mark pitched a fit, and we didn't run it. That issue, which is this, I made a copy of that, which you can have. This is the issue that did not run the column by Mark Lett.
So that's Friday, February 17th, right. 1961.
Right. And in that issue, the only thing that Dan did was to slug the line on the in the masthead of the paper that says the megaphone. Dan slugged below that the letter, the words of the administration, as a protest that we had been denied the right to print the column. A week later, with some, depends on your point of view, some minor or perhaps major editing, we were allowed to print Mark's column, and we printed that column. There it is, right there, in the paper on the 24th of February, 1961. And in that paper, we printed this column in which we questioned the practice of paying substandard wages to the African-American help on the campus at Southwestern. That's what the point was, that our university was not paying adequate wages to some of its help, and the only reason that they weren't paying them adequate wages was that they were black. And so that's what Mark had written about. That's what he had been denied the right we'd been denied the right to publish in the paper. And so it got edited the next week, and it was run the next week. At the same time, the Student Senate was passed a resolution in support of the sit-ins in Nashville and in Greenville. The president at the time was Finch. President Finch was the president. And Finch, who was out of town, by the way, when this issue of the megaphone came out, he returned and made the compromise that resulted in the printing of that column by Mark. Finch also met this same week after he got back, which is an interesting thing, with the Student Senate about the sit-in policy. and said that he thought it was okay for the student senate to pass a resolution supporting the sit-in practices in elsewhere. And the question was raised by some people in that event about whether or not we would, you know, would we be kicked out of school if we did the same thing? And the issue, the distinction that Finch made, he pointed out that the United Methodist Church, or it wasn't the United Methodist Church, pardon me, it was just the Methodist Church in 1960, had passed a resolution at its general meeting supporting the sit-ins, that had already been done. And so he said that, and therefore our resolution was certainly acceptable. But he did say we couldn't do anything that broke the law. Of course, the sit-ins broke the law. There were laws in those towns against integrated eating places. Now, whether there was a law in Williamson County that way or not, I don't know. I doubt it very seriously, because it never would have crossed anybody's mind. But in some of these sit-ins, laws were broken. And so the distinction is fishy. The interesting thing is that Finch had been in Nashville, Tennessee, talking to somebody about taking the job as the dean at Vanderbilt, and took the job as the dean at Vanderbilt right about the exact same time that Vanderbilt University expelled Jim Lawson, who was a student in the Divinity School, the theology school at Vandy, and was leading those sit-ins in Nashville. They expelled him, and the dean that Finch replaced, a guy named Bob Nelson, quit. That's the job Finch took when he went there. Now, I'd never talked to him, to Dr. Finch, before he died, just a year ago, I think, or year and a half ago that he died in Nashville. And I never talked to him about these events after he left. I did talk to him a couple of times before he left. But the employees at Southwestern University were paid, technically they were paid what the student help was paid. Of course, the student help didn't get any money. That was work study, and it paid part of your bills, your tuition or room and board. So there wasn't any money actually exchanged hands where the students were concerned. So in a sense, it was not quite comparable. But the fact was that officially, in some cases, the help that had been there for years were getting less money than the students were getting credit for against their accounts. So Mark says, talks about some of those things
it
here.
It says $22.50 per week and fringe benefits is what they were getting?
Some fringe. And some of the fringe benefits were leftovers that they could take home after meals. Now that's some of the fringe benefits.
So did Mark work with them?
Mark worked in the commons, yes.
So he learned all those talking
He knew these people because he washed dishes with them, or clean tables, or, you know, that was his work-study job. Mark lives in Austin. I mean, if you wanted to push the story, okay, we could call Mark, and you could talk to him. He knows more about it than I do. All this same time, there were the beginnings of discussions among the African-American community in Georgetown about how are we going to integrate the schools here.
Right.
Those discussions began at about this same time in the early 60s. Now, they didn't actually take root or have a great impact until probably 65 or 6, maybe 64. before. I was gone before. I was in Dallas when some of that happened and knew some of the people that were involved. Norman Spellman, who's still here in town, was involved in that and was a faculty member at Southwestern, now retired, and he lives here. Doug Benold, who was an MD here in town, was involved in that. And that had just begun to, well, maybe it hadn't just begun, but we had just begun to hear about it on the white side of town. We had just begun to hear that there was some talk about integrating the other aspects of Georgetown, particularly the public schools. That was the big issue, because Carver was named for the president of, or the principal, or whatever he was called, of that, of the high school. Marshall, I think his name was, which was up at the end of the ridge up over here. Sort of overlooked the Blue Hole.
Oh, really?
Right. It was up on Scenic, up near 2nd or 3rd Street, up that end of town. And it was a disaster. It was a disaster. The building, I mean. It was just pitiful. And so they had talked about integrating the schools because the conditions up there were terrible.
Can I ask, going back to this uh-huh. column, once it did appear in the newspaper, did people think this guy was a complete radical, or what was the really?
The Southwestern student body was, there were probably, this is just totally a guess, okay? 10 or 15%, maybe 20% of the student body would have been pretty supportive of Mark. Another between 10 and 20, again I'm guessing, would have been way opposed to Mark. Most of the student body could have cared less. Didn't matter to them one way or another. It's just not part of what they were thinking about at the time. There were a group of people on the campus in those days who were part of a growing conservative movement on college campuses, some of which was racist. And that was true at Southwestern. Those people who were, some of them were friends of mine, and some of them were on the paper staff at the time, on the Megaphone staff, they would certainly balk at that word racist. They would say that wasn't the case, but it was. Anyway, there were that, I'd say that's how the student body was split up. Myron Wickey, who was the dean at the time, and left when Finch did. Wickey left when Finch did. Myron Wickey was the dean, and he came by our fraternity house and asked a group of us who had been talking about integration of Southwestern if we would allow African Americans, of course that's not the word we used, we would allow Negroes membership in our fraternity. Well, that wasn't allowed in our national fraternity. We had a exclusionary national policy, which really put some of us in a bad way, because we couldn't say, yes, we would allow them full access. And he said, well, I think if we integrated the school, which I think is a good idea, Dean Wickey said, then we would demand that all of our campus organizations were fully allowed full integration.
Do you know when Southwestern was integrated?
About 5 years after that. In fact, I believe we're coming up on the 40th anniversary of it right now. I cannot remember the name of the man who was admitted. He was not the first to apply, by the way. But he was the first admitted. I cannot remember his name. If you're really interested in that, Dr. Shrum's office, Jake's office, could let you know that, or the person who's really organizing the 40th anniversary celebration of integrating the student body is Ron Swain, an assistant to the president at Southwestern.
They're going to have a celebration?
They're going to celebrate the 40th anniversary of the integration of the school. So that would have been, I finished in 62, so that would have been 68. Now that might have been the year he graduated, so maybe he enrolled in 64.
Okay.
I know that's about the time that I believe the man's name was Mitchell, who organized the integration of the public schools.
Oh, Harvey Miller?
Miller, yeah. That's about the time they organized the integration of the public schools.
And you had said the fraternity nationally wouldn't allow African Americans in. When the school integrated, did that change?
We had yes, the fraternity now does. Primarily because they would have been kicked off every campus in the country by now. The campuses themselves forced almost all fraternities to remove their exclusionary policies, or they couldn't exist anymore. And I would think that all of the, there were in those days four fraternities, which there still are on campus, and there were five sororities. I believe that's, there are only three now, or if there may be a new one. But there were, and I believe every one of them had exclusionary policies. I can't be 100% on that, but I think they did.
Did you have a lot of interaction with Dr. Spellman while you were a student?
No. I never had a class from Norman. He came here as a professor at just about the same time I did. When I came as a freshman, he just, that's about the same year, 58, maybe 1 year later or earlier, either one or the other, that he came. But I never ended up with a class with him. But I know him quite well, but and knew him then, but I never had a class with him.
I want to back up a little and kind of break down what happened here. You said Mark wrote the column.
Mark wrote the column. The way the paper worked in those days is that we took we edited the articles. Dan did, Adamson, usually the editor, and took them to the Sun, and the Sun set the type, and then. Because we were printed by the Williamson County Sun. Then we picked the papers up. Well, the typesetter at the Williamson County Sun told Don Scarborough, who was the publisher, editor, major domo of the Williamson County Sun at the time, told Don Scarborough what was in this column. Scarborough was concerned about that. It was, you know, a sticky wicket here in Georgetown. There were a lot of implications in his mind beyond the campus. And he notified the president's office. Now, I don't think Finch was in town at that time. In fact, Mark swears he wasn't. I've talked to Mark about this since, but whoever was in the serving then got really upset and told Mark that if he did anything like this again, he could be expelled from school. Now, when Finch came back, he said, that's not true. You know, that's not true. But that was some of the talk that was going on that week when that was pulled, which is why Dan slugged the masthead with that of the administration line the megaphone of the administration.
Meaning the Southwestern.
Right, meaning that the Southwestern administration runs this paper. This isn't a student publication, whatever they might say. So the Williamson County Sun was involved in getting that pulled. Now, Don Scarborough was a good guy. He was a good guy. And, he was what in those days would have been called a moderate Democrat.
Okay.
He wasn't, the Texas was all Democrats. You don't remember, but Texas was all Democrats in those years. But Don Scarborough and the paper sort of took a moderate track. They weren't super conservative Democrats. The Alan Shivers part of the party, which are really Republicans, but they just were called Democrats all over the South in those days. And he wasn't part of the Henry B. Gonzalez and Ralph Yarbrough, the liberal wing either. But Jim Wright, a congressman from Fort Worth at the time, and others were sort of the middle-of-the-road Democrats. And Don Yarbrough and the paper had that position. They weren't really super bad conservative type racist paper. But this was scary. This had to do with what everybody in town paid their help. You know, if Southwestern's wages went up, then how would the cafes here compete? How would the two motels, there were only two motels, one on the south end and one, the San Gabriel and the Parkway, they're still there. Those are the only two in town. And how would they hire their help? And, you know, this was a big issue. And the Sun had advertisers who might include some people who would be mad about such a thing.
So it wasn't just social, it was a financial thing.
Oh, it was economic. Okay. It was economic. And it always has to do with the money. You know, wasn't that the so-called deep throat's word in the Pentagon Papers? Follow the money. Well, it always has to do with money. It may have to do with other things, but it's always got to do with money. That's the claim that the school board made. How can we afford to build a new black high school? And since they couldn't afford to build a new black high school, that forced them. Now, that's not exactly the case, but that's one of the leading factors in integrating the schools. Because there was no way they were going to provide separate but equal facilities. They just couldn't do it. That Williams Elementary, you may not know this, that was the high school. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we should wrap up. Do you have anything else you want to say?
No, I think it's a story, the Southwestern story. That's just the beginning of the story, but I think it's worth some work on. And it's not the kind of thing that gets in the school history books.
Right.
You can read Bill Jones' history, which is good mm-hmm. for what it is. It's a very good history of Southwestern. And he talks about this issue, but the hard data is not in there about this, I don't think. And about Finch's role and what I'd really like to know what Finch knew about what was going on in Nashville when he took that job.
Okay, are you done?
I'm
turn it off?
Fine.